Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the Supercalmiocande detector, and in particular a study of the atmospheric neutrinos that we look at in the Supercalmiocande detector. Super-K is a collaboration between the United States and Japan, and there's something like a dozen or so universities on both the US and Japanese side, adding up to something like 120 people in the collaboration. So we list universities instead of names in our collaboration list. After you pass some threshold, it's a relatively small collaboration. Yeah. Okay, so what I'll talk about today is, first of all, what the physics goals of the detector were when we first built it. Then I'll give you a sort of a lengthy description of the detector itself and how it works, because I think it's fun. And then I'll give you the results of the data up to now, which is something like 1,300 days of live time, and analyze the atmospheric neutrino data in particular. And if I have time, I'll go through, well, certainly go through this, the flavor content that we see in the atmosphere, the zenith angle distribution of the data, which points towards neutrino oscillations. And then, depending on how much time I'll have, I'll speak about what our limits are on new mu, new sterile oscillations, and maybe some preliminary new tau appearance results that we have in the detector.
Hank, I wonder if there were a lot of biologists at the IPP up there. Actually, I see very few of them, so you don't have to worry about the biologists.
Okay, so. The biologists throw tomatoes or what? Okay, the detector was built to do nucleon decay, as was already mentioned. This is really a follow-up to the detectors that were built in the late 70s and early 80s, the IMB and Kamioka detectors. And in those days, we were looking for nucleon decay as predicted by SU5, which had a lifetime of something like 10 to the 29 with an error of plus or minus one or so in the exponent. Unfortunately, we didn't see nucleon decay, but we did see other things with the detector, which made it an interesting thing to do. For example, supernova 1987A exploded 150,000 years before we built the detector, but we happened to be on the air when the neutrinos came through the Earth. So that was very nice. Also, these detectors have looked at atmospheric neutrinos because, as you'll see, they're the primary background for looking for nucleon decay, and so therefore you have to understand the atmospheric neutrino signal very well. Also, solar neutrinos, the last thing on this list is now a long baseline experiment that we're doing with the Super-K detector, where we have a beam of neutrinos from the KEK laboratory, which is 250 kilometers away from Super-K, pointing towards the detector. So we have a near set of detectors, and Super-K as the far set of detectors. So we characterize the beam with the near set of detectors, and then we look for differences at 250 kilometers away as a way of verifying the atmospheric neutrino results. So Super-K looks something like this. There's a mountain, and there's a tunnel that's drilled in the mountain about 2 kilometers long. And at the end of the tunnel, we have this cavity excavated. Actually, it's a laboratory now. There are several other experiments going on there, so it's not just Super-K, but I'll talk just about Super-K. And at that point, we have this cavern that was excavated, which is about 40 meters in diameter and about 50 meters high. And in that region, we built the Super-K detector. And it looks like this, in a larger scale. It's a stainless steel tank, which is built into the hole by erecting steel plates piece by piece and then pouring concrete and rebar behind it between the rock and the tank to make a form fit. And then inside the stainless steel tank, there's a superstructure that's erected for holding the photomultiplier tubes about 2 to 3 meters away from the outer wall of the detector. And on this superstructure, we have phototubes mounted looking outside at this 2 or 3 meter region. and also on the inside looking in at the cylindrical volume. So the outer region is an anti-coincidence. It looks for particles that are coming in and signals their passage coming into the detector. And the inner region is our calorimeter, where we're actually doing the work. And each one of these dots represents a photomultiplier tube, which is 50 centimeters in diameter. So they're big, and there are a lot of them. So here's what the detector looks like as we were building it. We're standing on the bottom. So there's a person down here. And these are all the tubes looking up with the fisheye lens before it's finished being built. And then, of course, you fill the detector with water. And here's the picture which shows the water level coming up. And we're in boats polishing off the surface of the phototubes as the water level comes up to make sure they're nice and clean. We're going to do this again this summer. This summer we're going to be emptying the tank to replace some bad phototubes, so we get to see it again when it's empty. It's really spectacular. Not very many, less than 200 out of 11,000 since 1996, April 96. No, they aren't. We had some growing in the old IMB detector. Some kind of variant of Pseudomonas grew in the old IMB detector, which formed a transparent slime, which was very pleasant. It was on all the cables, all of our cables. As you picked them out of the water, this transparent slime would come off of it. But IMB was at a temperature of about 78 Fahrenheit. It was equilibrium with the rock temperature in the mine. Here, the rock temperature is much cooler because we're in a mountain instead of going straight down. And so we're about 11 degrees or 12 degrees centigrade. And so that must make the difference because we don't take any other special measures. The water, of course, is constantly recirculated through a water purification system. But we don't take any measures to put any chlorine or anything like that into the water because that would spoil the light transmission. And we need excellent optical transmission in order to see the photons that are given off. So that obviously leads into this. This is how we see a particle in the detector. When a charged particle passes through the water faster than the speed of light in water, it gives off Cherenkov radiation. The Cherenkov radiation comes out at a characteristic angle to the track given by beta and the index of refraction of the material. For water, this is 1.3, and for particles going close to the speed of light, theta is about 41 degrees. So the photons come out at an angle of 41 degrees to the track. Of course, as the track slows down, then the light shrinks down, and theta gets smaller. So the way detector works is to use the timing and the number of photons that every photomultiplier tube sees. So this is a schematic. The black dots are representing photomultiplier tubes, and the red line is, say, a charged particle, a muon, that's going through the detector. Okay? So the green squiggly lines are photons that are emitted at this 41 degrees to the track that I mentioned. And the blue line is a line of constant time. So each one of these photons arrive at this point in space at the same time because they're traveling faster than the track is. Okay? So for example, what do you see? Well, as this muon goes through the detector, first this phototube would see a photon, then this one, et cetera, until you got down to, say, here. At this point, this photon, this phototube, and this phototube would see photons at the same time, then this one and this one, for example. And now if you look at the bottom, these two would see it at the same time, and then further on out in R, so you'd see an expanding bullseye pattern of light as the particle went through. Now, of course, if the particle doesn't go all the way through, doesn't have enough energy, loses enough energy, and stops in the detector, then instead of getting light all the way down here, it stops at that point, obviously, and what you see is a ring in the detector instead of a filled-in bullseye. And of course, the width of the ring is proportional to the length of the track. Number of photoelectrons that you accumulate is proportional to total energy that's deposited in the detector. And you have to calibrate to calculate all these things. Okay, so what you want to do is to reject various topologies. So if a particle is going through, then what it is most likely a muon that's come down through this 1 kilometer of rock that's above our heads. We don't screen out all of the muons. We're underground to get rid of the muons, which are a background to us. We don't screen out all of them. You have to go down to 12,000 meters water equivalent to get down to the level of neutrino-induced muons. So there's more and more, less and less as you go underground, but there's still a lot going through the detector. So we have a big background of cosmic ray muons going through, ones that stop, for example. And so you use topology to eliminate those kinds of events. You see the track entering, and you see the topology of the event. Now remember, there are so many photomultipliers that are hit by a track going through, and you know the timing to 1 nanosecond on each tube, and you know the angle that the photon comes off the track, and therefore you can make a constrained fit, and you know exactly what the track of the particle is. Okay? Now, what we're looking for is proton decay, originally, right? And so what you look for in that case is a very different kind of topology. There's no entering track. The vertex is somewhere inside your fiducial volume of the detector, and you typically would have back-to-back tracks, for example, in an E plus pi zero kind of mode where a proton decayed. So you conserve momentum, and total energy has to be the energy of the proton.
So pi zero would still produce...
Yeah, pi zero decays into 2 gamma rays very quickly, and you see the 2 gamma rays which produce showering tracks in the detector. And this one is a typical neutrino interaction. No entering particle and a single lepton exiting the vertex.
How do you know it's not proton decaying to
pi zero? That could happen too, but we're afraid we can't see those because there's too much background from neutrino interaction. So we'd never be able to distinguish that kind of event. I think they're small compared to the number of neutrino interactions, however. So the way the detector works is first you look at the events in order to generate the kinds of algorithms that you need to analyze the data automatically. And so this is a display, and you take the detector and you slice it down the side, down the vertical side, and you unfold it, and you make cut the top and the bottom, and you fold them up like tin can. Okay, so this is an unfolded cylinder. Each dot represents a photomultiplier tube. Now in this picture, the color represents the number of photons that the phototube saw. Okay, so red means a lot of photons. Actually, there's a scale down here, 16 photoelectrons, and it goes down to like blue or violet is around 4 or so. So there's a scale that you calibrate.
So okay? The detectors on the top of the thing can.
Yeah, these are the phototubes. The phototubes totally enclose the cylinder, the sides and the top and bottom. And also, I didn't mention that there's this anti-coincidence region, the 2 meters outside the inner volume, which we look to see if a particle is entering. And that data is shown up here in this corner. And if you look carefully, you can see, I could see anyway, an entry spot over here where the muon came into the anti-coincidence. Okay, so now, of course, there are a lot of complicated events. Here's an event where 2 muons from a shower in the atmosphere came down and went through the detector. In this case, I'm not showing the number of photoelectrons, I'm showing timing. So red are phototubes that are hit early, and then using the spectrum, tubes that are hit later and later and later in time. Okay, and this is a Cherenkov pattern that went down like this, and see a grazing blow on the side of the cylinder.
Two muons.
Coming
from some part of the
thing? No, it's from a shower in the atmosphere that produced 2 muons coming down. Yeah, you could see. Well, it's hard to see here, but you could see a lot of light in the anti-coincidence. Okay, so now those are backgrounds. Let me show you what neutrino interactions look like, because we're going to use that in the atmospheric neutrino data analysis. So this is, as I'll show you later, a muon neutrino interaction. Muon neutrino came in, produces a muon, has a certain length track in the detector, and it forms this ring that we were talking about before, where there's no entry spot, there's no light up here, no particle entered, but you get a ring in the detector, okay? And this particular ring, this display is showing the number of photoelectrons that each tube sees, intensity. And this plot on the left is timing. So we display a histogram of the time that each tube is hit from some zero point that we pick, the trigger of the trigger of the detector, okay? So it's this is a very long spread out event in time. I'll talk about this in a second. Now, what you'd like to do is to know where the track was and where the vertex of the event was in the detector, where the neutrino interaction occurred. And so, figuratively, you could take a track, guess a vertex and a track, for example, and then from that vertex and track, you can calculate the time that each photomultiplier tube should be hit, because you know the angle that the photon comes off the track, and you know the distance to every photomultiplier tube. So you do that, and you calculate that and compare it to the actual time that the phototube is hit. And you take the subtraction of the two, and that's called timing residuals. What you want to do is to minimize the timing residuals. When it's minimized, then you know you've found the correct track, okay? So now I've done that to that same event we saw a minute ago, and now the timing, you see, is sharpened up. So the timing residuals, this is now I'm plotting timing residuals, not the actual time of the event. But the residual is now sharp, so I know I've gotten to a good vertex and track direction. And what's plotted here now is the time that each tube was hit. So if it's all one color, then you know that it's within a very small integral of time. So this goes from 912 nanoseconds to 930 nanoseconds, this particular color, okay? Now, this plot is a plot of the cosine of the angle from the vertex that we picked in the detector to each photomultiplier tube. So if we're at the correct location in space, then there should be some Cherenkov angle, this 41 degrees, and all the light should be inside of that Cherenkov angle, okay? And that's what this red line is. That's the Cherenkov angle from the vertex that we picked in our reconstruction, okay? Now you'll notice that there is some light to the left of the red line, and that's due to scattering of light in the detector, okay? Now try and keep in your mind's eye how much light there is to the left of that red line, because we're going to compare it to another kind of track in a second. Another way of looking at this, huh? Yes, the red line is drawn at 41 degrees.
Is there a question?
Yeah. Sorry? Scattering. Now, one detector length, depending on which direction the track was going. The light will bounce off and come back the other direction. So it's well separated in time. This is timing. So this is late light here. This is larger. Yes, this is cosine theta, right? Okay, so now we took that same event that we just looked at and project it now onto a cylinder, just so it looks nicer, because when you have tracks that hit the side of a detector like that, they get distorted and you can't really see the circular pattern very well. So now the outer white line, white circle, is the Cherenkov angle, okay? And this is, the inner one is where we think the track stopped. So there shouldn't be any light on the inside of that, except for light that's put in because the particle is slowing down and the Cherenkov angle is getting smaller. So the light, look at the light outside. So look at the sharpness of this ring, in other words, compared to the white line, okay? Because now I'm going to show you an electron neutrino interaction. So now, here is the raw interaction after we've reconstructed the vertex. So here's the vertex reconstructed. Here's the Cherenkov angle once again, and notice the amount of light to the left of the Cherenkov angle. There's a lot more here now. And you'll be able to see it even better in the cylindrical projection. So here's the Cherenkov angle. You can see all of this light outside of the Cherenkov angle. And the reason is that an electron produces a showering track. So electron produces pair production. You get gamma rays. And gamma rays produce electron, positron, more, and you get a big shower, electromagnetic shower. And that spreads out the Cherenkov light. Whereas a muon is a non-showering track, and you get a fairly well-defined outer Cherenkov angle. Okay? So based on this topology, we're going to be able to tell the difference between electron neutrinos and muon neutrinos in the detector. Okay? So, of course, we don't only see single tracks. Here's some more complicated things that occur. This is a neutrino interaction. There's no entering particle. Lots of tracks. Here's what it looks like after it's been reconstructed. You can see lots of Cherenkov circles in the detector. For the most part, we don't really analyze events like this. Our first analysis, we just started analyzing multi-track events. Up to now, we've looked at only single-track events, because in order to be able to tell the difference between an electron and a muon neutrino, we don't want the ambiguity that occurs when you have more than one track. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So those are several neutrinos?
This is one neutrino interaction, lots of pions being produced.
Now, how do you define an event when you take a picture?
An event is defined by a certain number of photomultipliers tubes going off within a trigger window.
I see. So then you take a picture like that?
Well, you don't take a picture. You store the data. You store the data.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And how often does that happen?
Well, we trigger, depends on the detector, as I said, does a lot of different kinds of physics. Atmospheric neutrinos trigger the detector at the order of 2 per second. Mm-hmm. These are mostly muons that are coming down through the atmosphere and triggering the detector. It's a large detector. On the other hand, we trigger now at about 200 times per second, because we're also looking at solar neutrinos, and we want to go down to very, very low thresholds. So we work now at a threshold of about 4.3 MeV. So we trigger this detector at 4.3 MeV in order to get 100% efficiency up at around 4.5 to 5 MeV.
And that's 20 times per second.
And we're constantly marching the threshold down as we understand our backgrounds a little more and get more computing power. We can go lower and lower in threshold. Okay, so now we're going to come on to, so that supposedly now you understand how the detector works, and now we're going to look at atmospheric neutrino data. So, atmospheric neutrinos, as you know, you get primary cosmic rays in the atmosphere, mostly protons. They hit the Earth in a fairly symmetric way, as at high energies at least. And you get showers, and the showers produce this cascade of secondaries. And so, for example, if you look at a pion decay, so you look at a pi plus, this arrow is in the wrong place, but you get a pi plus, you get a muon and a muon neutrino, and then the mu plus decays, and you get an e plus and a muon neutrino and an electron neutrino. So for every pi decay, you get two muon-type neutrinos and one electron-type neutrino. Right? So in general, that's what you get, with a ratio of about 2 to 1 of muon-type neutrinos to electron-type neutrinos as a hand-waving argument. And of course, this has become an industry, and there are a number of groups that just calculate the atmospheric neutrinos based on their own versions of Monte Carlos in the atmosphere. And it's getting more and more sophisticated, but still you get fairly close to 2 to 1, even after all the mess. The problem has been, in the past, that we don't know the primary proton flux that well. And so we've only been able to predict the atmospheric neutrinos to plus or minus 20%. This is the absolute flux, plus or minus 20% or so. It's getting somewhat better now, but it's still not very good. On the other hand, the ratio of the two flavors, the number of muon neutrinos to the number of electron neutrinos, as you saw, is independent of flux. And so you can predict that to a much better precision, the order of plus or minus 5% is what the industry tells us, plus or minus 5%. There's no calibration other than, there's some measurements in the atmosphere which they use to calibrate their Monte Carlos. People measure muon rates in the atmosphere, things like that. But we can't calibrate it, we just take what they give us. So that really is the whole problem, or has been the problem since the days of the early observations. As you'll see, people observed that this number R, which is the ratio of the number of muon neutrinos to electron neutrinos we see in the data compared to what's predicted, is less than one, and has been less than one for since 1984 or so. Various detectors confirming that it's less than one. And so, on the other hand, it's difficult to say that that's due to neutrino oscillations, because there are a lot of other handles that could produce that kind of result, right? There were a whole load of papers that were produced that talk about ways of getting R without using neutrino oscillations. Now, people have gone through all these things, and we think we've eliminated them, but it still remained possible for just a problem in the atmospheric neutrino Monte Carlos. So you needed some kind of smoking gun to show that was really neutrino oscillations and not just a normalization problem. So what I'll talk about now is what we see with Super K. We see various kinds of atmospheric neutrino interactions. In general, a neutrino could come in, this is a neutrino, comes in producing a lepton. A lepton could be totally contained inside your detector. We call these fully contained events. At the same time, a neutrino interaction can also occur inside your fiducial volume, but the lepton, in particular muon, can exit the detector if it has enough energy. So these we call partially contained events. And then there's a whole other class of events which we analyze as a check. And these are due to neutrino interactions which occur underneath the detector in the rock. And they produce a muon, and the muon shoots up through the detector or stops in the detector. And these are, we call upward going muons, through going and stopping categories. And they're different energies, as you'll see. So what I'll tell you about today is this 1289 live day sample, which is about 80 kiloton years. We have 22.5 kiloton fiducial volume in this detector. So first thing we do is to look at the number of rings in an event. Now, as I said, we're going to concentrate initially on just single ring events to avoid these ambiguities that I was talking about. Analyze only single ring events. So this is a histogram of what we observe, number of rings that we observe in each event compared to what's predicted by the Monte Carlo. You can see it's generally less than the Monte Carlo right away, but of course that's not a particular worry because we have plus or minus 20% uncertainty in a normalization. So this is absolutely normalized. It's not fudged. Okay, so here we see something like 8.2 events per day of neutrino interactions in the detector. The Monte Carlo tells us we should be seeing something like 9.8. And the same sort of thing for the partially contained events. We see something like 0.6, and we should be seeing something like 0.8 according to the Monte Carlo. So, historical reasons, we divided the data up in one other way, something we call sub-GEV and multi-GEV. So this histogram is the visible energy in the detector for only one ring events. That's the visible energy of all the events in the detector, one ring, two ring, three rings. This is only the single ring events, and this is only the partially contained events. So we make a cut everywhere from about 100 MeV up to 1.3 GeV. We call this category sub-GeV. And everything above 1.3 GeV we call multi-GeV events. So we make single ring, single track cut, and we cut on the energy of the event. And then we do particle identification. And this is based on the topology, as I showed you earlier, plus a calibration that we did. We made a 1 kiloton water Cherenkov detector at the KEK laboratory and directed beams of electrons and muons, separated beams of muons and electrons, into the detector from about 100 MeV up to 1 GeV. And we tested all our algorithms on it to make sure that they were correct. So this is a likelihood function, which separates the E-like events with muon-like events, right? So our misidentification is the order of 1 or 2% based on these results. So here's our result for R. As I said, it's less than 1. It's around 0.64, 0.65. This is the low-energy sample, the sub-GeVs, and these are the high-energy samples. They're both less than 1, significantly less than 1, and it's many, many, many standard deviations now, so it's not a question of statistics in any sense. You can compare this to the other detectors that have been running over the years, and these are the results that people have gotten for this number R as a function of experiment. So here's the one I just told you about, the low energy and the high energy super K results. Here's the old IMB results. Here's the old Kamiokande results. And these two up here were the Nusex and Frejus results that troubled people for a long time, because they were iron calorimeters, very different from the water Cherenkov detectors. And people thought that maybe there was something about the water Cherenkov detectors that gave them a lower muon observation, lower muon efficiency. Recently, the Sudan detector now, which is another ion calorimeter, now gets the same sort of results that the water Cherenkov detectors do. But obviously, that was a worry then. And if you only had this data, it would be a worry now. So here's a list that I've gotten out of the literature on what people have said could be the reason for the low value of R. First one on the list is one that I really love. They said that the muon deficit is really an electron excess from proton decay to E plus nu. And so you have, that one's in the category we should be so lucky, I think. Unfortunately, it's not true. And experimentally, it's not true because we see the anomaly extending to way above 1 GeV. So it can't be true. OK, then could be a high-energy neutron background, some people say, where you get pi zeros. High-energy neutrons come in and give you pi zeros. The pi zeros give you the gamma rays, would look like electron neutrino events. We think we've ruled this out with the super K detector. One of the big advantages of super K is that it's big. I mean, that's really the only big advantage of it over the over other generations. It's big and has a lot of good light collection. And it's so big that you can see things coming in. You can make cuts as a function of R. So you can know what your background is by looking at the data as a function of R. You can also isolate small portions of your data set and still have enough statistics to say something about it. That's the big advantage. And that's how eventually we do the atmospheric zenith angle work, because we have so much data, we can now afford to cut it up into zenith angle instead of just looking at one big lump. Okay, so particle ID problems. As I said, we've done a beam test at KEK to test this, and that was okay. I'm not going to go through all this, but except for the last one. Of course, you can always say all the flux calculations are wrong, no matter how well the people who do the work jump up and down and say it's right. I mean, it still could be wrong. And so no one's going to push neutrino oscillations based on something like that. So you have to have some other proof.
Notice you give the reference system without the author.
Yes. Trying to be tactful. Yeah.
Sort of thinking about it, one might think that muon events have a different Q squared, so it might be more likely to make multi-beam, not stay single.
Yeah. that goes under the category of the efficiency for seeing the electron events is higher than the efficiency for seeing the muon events. And that's something that we can really never rule out. Also, people said that maybe the cross section, here's another way, maybe when the muon comes out, it has a certain energy spectrum. Maybe the energy spectrum is a little bit lower than we calculate it to be. And so a larger fraction of the muons are below Cherenkov threshold. And then you would be less efficient for seeing them. So these are the kind of things that that people have written papers about and say that it's not true and can't explain the effect, but no one would be convinced unless you did some other experiment to prove it. No one's ever looked at water as a target. That was a problem. We're just now doing water as a target now. So maybe it's neutrino oscillations. And if it's neutrino oscillations, then the phenomenology looks like this. You get that the probability of neutrino turning from one neutrino into another neutrino goes like this relationship, where this theta is the mixing angle, fraction of time that one neutrino goes into another neutrino. This delta m squared represents the difference in the square of the masses of neutrino eigenstates. Presumably there are three neutrino eigenstates, and you're looking at a linear combination of neutrino eigenstates to make up a flavor state. L is the travel distance of the neutrino from its point of origin, and E is neutrino energy. And so if you look at this argument, and set it equal to n pi, you can find that the travel distance goes as the constant times E over delta m squared. Okay? So the bigger delta m squared is, the smaller the mean free path of neutrino oscillations is. Okay? So we're going to use that. We have a lucky circumstance. Instead of having an accelerator where we have detectors at two different distances, we have the Earth. And so we managed to put the accelerator at different distances from our detector. Okay? So the neutrinos are coming at all directions to the atmosphere. And so neutrinos that come from the other side of the Earth have traveled something like 13,000 kilometers before they get to us. Neutrinos coming straight down overhead have gone about 15 kilometers. Right? And so since the oscillation length goes as E over delta m squared for a given energy spectrum, then we're going to be sensitive to a certain range of delta m squared if we want to see a difference between downward going and upward going events. Now, the way we tell which direction it's going is we reconstruct the direction of the outgoing lepton. So the neutrino, muon neutrino produces a muon. We reconstruct the direction of the muon in the detector. So this is only good to the extent that the neutrino, that the direction of the muon corresponds to the incoming direction of the neutrino. So here's a histogram showing you that, let's say, for example, for muon-type events, this is the opening angle, the angle between the incident neutrino direction and the outgoing lepton, the muon, as a function of lepton momentum. So you could see when you get down here to low momentums, down around, here's this blue line is about 400 MeV, then the opening angle gets to be fairly large. This is 30 degrees. I mean, this here is about 40 degrees. Here we're up close to 70 degrees already. So you have to be above about 400 MeV to have a reasonable correlation between the lepton direction and the neutrino direction. Okay, so this plot is supposed to give you a feeling for the sensitivity. So now what we're going to plot here is the angular distribution of the muon neutrinos producing angular distribution of the observed muons from muon neutrino interactions in the detector. Okay? Now, if there's no oscillations, then the black curve, represents what we'd expect for the angular distribution. This, what we're plotting here, I didn't write down, is cosine of the zenith angle. So when cosine is zero, this means events that are coming straight down above our heads, And cosine minus one is things that are coming up. Okay? So these are upward going events, minus one here. This is plus one, and this is zero, representing the horizon. Okay? And it's not a flat line, even though the neutrinos are being produced uniformly around the Earth because of what's called an old cosmic ray effect called the secant theta effect. And that simply goes, it's simple. You get muon neutrinos because the pion decays and produces a muon neutrino, and then the muon decays and produces a muon neutrino. Now, if the muon has enough energy that it hits the Earth before it decays, then you don't get that second muon neutrino. So muons that are coming straight down above your head have a smaller atmosphere to go through, and therefore more likely to interact with the Earth before they decay. And as you go to larger and larger angles, and you have a longer path length for the muons, you get more muon decaying and giving you neutrino. Okay? So up and down is about the same, and the horizon is larger. Okay, so now you take this unoscillated angular distribution, and now you say, what happens if delta m squared is equal to some value? So I'll start with 10 to the minus 4. If delta m squared is 10 to the minus 4, it turns out that the oscillation length is just long enough that things that are coming all the way up through the Earth oscillate a little bit. And when they oscillate, what happens is the muon neutrino turns into something that we can't see. It turns into, say, a tau neutrino, or, say, electron neutrinos, possibly. Okay? Either one of those we couldn't see. Electron neutrino, because the range of the electron in the rock, range of the electron would be small. Okay, we wouldn't be able to see it very well. And we don't see an increase in electron neutrinos, so we can see whether it goes into electron neutrinos or not. If it goes into tau neutrinos, then the threshold for tau neutrino interactions in our detector is very high, and so we don't see those. They're almost invisible to us. Okay, almost invisible. So they essentially disappear. Okay, so you'd start to see a deformation in the angular distribution for things that are coming straight up. As delta m squared gets larger, 10 to the minus 3, now all the things that are coming straight up have oscillated into equilibrium, and even things that are coming up at an angle like this have had time to oscillate, path length long enough to oscillate, right? You go to 10 to the minus 2, and now you start seeing things from even quite above the horizon have enough region to oscillate. We get to 10 to the minus 1, even things that are coming straight down have had enough path length to oscillate. Now this tells us our region of sensitivity, because at this point, the shape of this curve looks just like the shape of the initial curve, except a normalization shift. So at that point, there's no smoking gun. All we have is a change in normalization, and we can't say anything based on the shape, right? So only between here and here is a reasonable region for us to be able to say anything based on the size of the Earth. And luckily enough, turns out we... This part, this, oh, yeah, right. Oh, second pattern. Okay, so that's what we're supposed to see, and this is what we see. Okay, so now, what I've done here is divide this up into two different parts. One part is energy, so each column is different energy. These are low energy events to the left, which less than 400 MeV, between 400 and 1.3 GeV, greater than 1.3 GeV, and these are another category, fully contained plus partially contained, which are high energy also. And then the top row are electron neutrino events, and the bottom row are muon neutrino events. Okay? So now the gray histogram, the boxes, are our Monte Carlos of what we'd expect the angular distribution to look like if there was no oscillations for each category. And the data points are the data, obviously. Okay, so let's look at this one. The electron neutrinos, the data looks pretty much like the Monte Carlo. There's no normalization here. This is all absolutely normalized.
Well, where is the 20%?
It's not in here.
Why are they both 20%?
Pardon me?
Why doesn't it appear to be...
It's uncertainty of 20% in the prediction, but
No,
we're plotting our data based on the absolute prediction, but the prediction seems to be fairly good. There's an error of plus or minus 20% on the prediction, but it's okay. I mean, oh, you mean the width of the error bar?
No, I'm well. May I talk to you after? Your earlier number is 1%.
Right. So that what that means is that these things should have a 20% error bar on them, which is not shown.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was trying to get. But
that goes into the Monte Carlo.
Surprisingly, the electrons look.
Yeah.
The prediction and the
right. It's within.
It's better than the 20% of W.
It just happened to be the guys who are doing the job seem to be better than they think they are. Okay, so data didn't agree with Monte Carlo. No.
That's what I thought.
That's R. Yeah, that's R. No, this is the first time I'm showing electron neutrinos and muon neutrinos. That R, which is the ratio of muon neutrinos to electron neutrinos observed, divided by muon neutrinos to electron neutrinos predicted.
You have raw numbers of events, but
they're
different.
Oh. But those were all put together. We hadn't separated them into electron neutrinos and muon neutrinos yet.
Okay.
The total sample is lower than the prediction, and presumably that's mostly due to the muon neutrinos being down.
Okay, that is.
Yeah. Okay, so now same thing for the muons, and now here's the prediction for the muon angular distribution at this energy, and this is what we see. Now you notice there's not any shape here, and the reason is it's less than 400 MeV. There's no correlation between the lepton direction and the neutrino directions. It's all washed out. As you go to higher energies, the electrons and still agree. The muons, you now see this deviation. So the things that are coming up disagree with the Monte Carlo. The things that are coming down pretty much agree with the Monte Carlo. So we're lucky. The Earth is just the right size for us to be able to see this thing. And so based on this, you can fit the data to the best fit for sine squared 2 theta and delta m squared. Okay, so that's what I'll do in a minute. Yes, we do, because we looked for something called the east-west effect. The Earth's magnetic field has an effect on low-energy incoming cosmic rays, because they're mostly positive. And so you'd expect to see a deficit in one direction rather than the west. And so you could look for that effect, and we observe it. So we see a very nice east-west effect. If I have time, I'll show you at the end. Yes, we do see that.
So that does give you some sense of the energy of the cosmic rays, but that isn't something helping you with the puzzle about the cosmic rays that are contributing to
it. Doesn't give us an absolute normalization.
No, but it tells you what.
It tells you that we know what we're doing in terms of reconstructing the events. We do see an effect that hadn't been observed before but was predicted in the azimuthal direction. So what I'm going to talk about now is that we're going to use the, so far I've used only the contained events, neutrino interactions inside the detector, right? So now I'm going to look at neutrinos interact underneath the detector and shoot their muon up through the detector. And so we're going to use that as I say, just supporting evidence, because the data there is not really good enough to make a claim based on that all by itself. But you can analyze it based on what we see in the contained events and see if it agrees. So it's a confirmation rather than anything else. If it was dramatically different, then we'd be very worried. So here is the energy spectrum. This is the neutrino energy that produces the kinds of events that, for example, goes into the fully contained sample, the fully contained electron sample, and the partially contained sample. So these are down around 1 GeV for the fully contained events, and here close to 10 GeV or so for the mean energy for the partially contained events. The upward going events are much higher energy. These are the through going events, and they're typically about 100 GeV of energy, and these are down around 10 GeV. So it's a different energy range that we're probing by doing this test. And so this is what we see in the data. These are the upward through-going events. Once again, this is the same cosine theta plot, except we stop at zero. We don't look up because we're dominated by downward-going muons from the atmospheric neutrino interaction, atmospheric proton interaction. Right? We only look below the horizon. So these are the upward going events that go through the detector. The solid histogram is the prediction with no neutrino oscillations, and the points are what we observe in the data. These are the muons that stop, upward going muons that stop in the detector. This is the prediction, and this is what we observe. And remember, this is a probes a different energy region, right? If you have a certain energy spectrum going through the detector, the ones that stop are just the ones that have this certain width on the energy plot, right? That have enough width to go through. The width of the detector determines that thickness of the detector. Okay, so we put all that together, and we get an allowed region in sine squared 2 theta delta m squared space, which looks like so. So our 99% confidence level is this green line. And we quote a best fit point, which is sine squared 2 theta is 1. Best fit is 1. 1.00 something. And so if you plot this on the other side, you'd see ellipses here centered right on this axis. And delta m squared is about 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3. Okay? And that gives you a very good fit chi-squared to the data compared to zero oscillations chi-squared, which is horrible. Okay, so this value, you shouldn't take this seriously. If you look at a plot of the chi-squared distribution, it's not something that looks like this. It looks sort of flat at the bottom, okay? So it's pretty flat along here. So the best fit point is just that. It's a best fit point. It's not real. It's somewhere between here is all we could say. Well, we like to quote as bigger than around 0.88 degrees at 90% confidence level. Okay, so now we take that best fit value for sine squared 2 theta and delta m squared, and we say, what should the angular distributions look like for each of those energy ranges and particle types based on those parameters? So for example, here's multi-GeV, high energy, muon-like, plus partially contained events. So this is the angular distribution for no oscillations. That's the red curve. The data is the dots, and the green curve, green histogram, is what you would predict with those values of sine squared 2 theta and delta m squared. So you can see that over a very large range of energy, we agree with what we see in the data. Okay? All the way from 100 MeV up to hundreds of GeV. Now you can look at this in a number of different ways. Okay, so let me skip that and then just let me go on to one other thing that's, I think, particularly interesting, and that is our limits on nu mu nu sterile oscillations. Obviously, all we know is that the muon neutrino is going away. It doesn't look like it's going into electron neutrinos because we would have seen a hump where you see a deficit in the muons. You would have seen more in the electron neutrinos. And so you can set a limit on that, which means it's less than a couple of percent going into the electron neutrinos. Also, there's a reactor experiment called SHO, which sets a limit on the fraction of time that the electron antineutrino disappears. Okay? And that gets a better limit than us on nu mu going into nu e. So we think it's nu mu going into nu tau. But it could also be going into a sterile neutrino. Okay, so what's the limits on that? So what we're going to do is take advantage of two effects. First one is that we're going to look at neutral current events in the detector, try and isolate a sample of neutral current interactions. Now, if we look at neutral current interactions, and the muon neutrino is going into a tau neutrino, we should still see the same number of neutral current interactions. It interacts the same way in neutral current. If on the other hand, the muon neutrino is going into a sterile neutrino will not give neutral current interactions. And so you'll see a difference. That's one effect. Second effect is, it turns out that if you look at matter effects for sterile neutrinos, here's the formula for nu A going into nu B that we showed before. This mixing angle in matter gets another term. It looks like this. Psi minus cosine 2 theta squared, where this function is the energy times some potential, effective potential, divided by delta M squared. So at high energies, this becomes very big, and it drives the mixing angle to zero. So for high energies, matter effects suppress oscillations in sterile neutrinos, okay? So you'd have no oscillations in the case of sterile neutrinos at high energies. So we take a couple of different samples of our data to try and look at that. First thing, the matter effects between an electron neutrino and a muon neutrino has to do with the different interactions between that a muon neutrino and an electron neutrino can have in matter, right? I mean, a muon neutrino interacts just by neutral current in regular matter, but an electron neutrino interacts by charge current and whatnot. So you get a phase difference between the muon neutrino and the electron neutrino, which produces a matter effect. Same thing with the sterile neutrino. There's a difference between the sterile neutrino interaction and the muon neutrino interaction in matter, which produces a phase difference.
So it's all the muon neutral current with the
interaction?
The mu sterile has the neutral
current? At high energies, mm-hmm. The mu sterile doesn't have...
Nothing, but the new mu in matter only has neutral.
Yes, right.
So it's all mu neutral versus
mu sterile. Mu sterile, nothing, right. So what we tried to do is to isolate different data samples to look at this, okay? So the first data sample is we take our data, we try and make a neutral current enriched sample. So we make some cuts in the data, and we end up with a sample that's something like 29 or 30% neutral current, this particular sample we're working with now. Okay, and we plot the cosine theta, the angular distribution of that sample. And for that sample, remember, if it's neutral current events, then the sterile neutrinos don't make neutral current events. So you won't see events in the upward going hemisphere, because the sterile neutrinos won't produce neutral currents. Whereas tau neutrinos, you will, and so you'll see an angular distribution which is fairly symmetric, because the tau neutrinos will still produce neutral currents, even if they go from nu to tau, right? And the data is plotted in comparison to what you expect. Well, we use our Monte Carlos to develop cuts which isolate neutral current events from the data. So we take a known sample of events based on our Monte Carlo generation of neutrino interactions, and we develop cuts in order to isolate a neutral current sample. Same thing, so now we also need a high energy sample. So one high energy sample is the partially contained events, which are something like greater than 5 GeV deposited in the tank, but like 10 GeV neutrino interactions, you remember from the curve we showed earlier. Now, for the high energy events, what we expect now is that the sterile neutrinos will not have oscillation effects, right? So if they don't have oscillation effects, then you'll see more of them in the upward going region than you will the tau neutrinos, right? So the curves roll are reversed. Here the red's above the green, here the green is above the red. This is another sample of high energy events. These are the through-going up muons, which have neutrino energies of the order of 100 GeV or so. Okay? Right. If you had pure neutral current events.
Right. The shape is now, because you've got some mixed charge effects in there, so it's less.
Which shape are you referring to? Which, I mean, what? I mean, why does it look like this? I mean,
that's roughly.
That has to do with, yeah.
That might. But the function of energy will change.
If you had pure neutral current, if you're able to have a pure sample of neutral current events, then you could check this in a more pure way.
Exactly.
But you still have the same effect between sterile neutrinos and tau neutrinos.
Yeah,
right. Now, let me take a diversion. A way of getting a pure sample of neutral current events is look at pi zero interactions in your detector. Okay. So we've done that. The only problem is that you want to go to high energies. In order to see this, you have to analyze the neutral current events at high energies. Now, the way you see a pi zero in the detector is that the pi zero decays into two gamma rays. And so you have to be able to see two rings, two showering rings. The problem is, as you go to high energies, you know what happens to the two rings? They come together. And so you get an overlap, and we're not very efficient in identifying pi zeros at high energies, so we don't have enough statistics to be able to do that. Okay, so that's the raw data. And then what we do is we take some ratios. So this plot says, look at this one where I can reach it. This is the data and the error on the data, okay, for the up-down ratio of high-energy partially contained events. So the other handle we have is that downward-going events are not oscillating, upward-going events are. So we can look at the up-down ratio to see the difference between the two sides, right? Okay, so here's what we see in the data, this error band. This is what we'd expect for the up-down ratio if nu mu was going to nu sterile, and this is what we'd expect if nu mu was going to nu tau. Okay? And this is a function of delta m squared. Okay? So our data, we're getting something like 2 or 3 times 10 to the minus 3, so we're right about over here. So you can see in this region, we're agreeing much more with nu mu nu tau than the nu mu nu sterile in this particular plot. Okay? Same sort of thing in the other plots. Here is this region right here. We agree with nu mu nu tau and don't agree with nu mu nu sterile. And the same thing up here, except they're reversed in direction. Here, we're agreeing with nu mu nu tau and not agreeing with nu mu nu sterile. Okay, for the three different regions. So you can put all that together. Well, we put the errors into the analysis here. The errors in here, this is, we have the errors on the data, but we don't have the errors in the prediction. It's a function of delta M squared, and it's different than each one of the plots. And some of them are large, and some of them are small. The largest is the order of 15%. It's not insignificant, but that's why you have to stick it into it when you do your final results. And so this is what we do. So we plot here, say on this upper plot. This is the allowed region based on a fully contained sample, which is not the same sample that we're using for this analysis. So we've isolated the sample and kept that separate. It's just a fully contained sample of lower energy. And then we say, what do we exclude? This is delta m squared here, and this is sine squared 2 theta, and this is nu mu nu tau. So we don't exclude, based on nu mu nu tau, we don't exclude anything more than about up to here. This is excluded 99%, and this is at 90%. Now, in the two nu mu nu sterile ways, this is depending on which delta m squared, which delta m squared greater than zero and less than zero, we exclude the entire allowed region at 99%. So what we say is that, of course, we're only basing this on a simple model. Nu mu is either going all the way into nu sterile, and that's it, or nu mu is only going into nu tau, not some mixture. There are other people now who have analyzed our data with a mixture of nu mu nu tau and nu mu nu sterile. And you can't rule it out completely. There's always some small fraction of nu sterile that's allowed. There's a reference to that analysis. Okay, so now I better stop and you can ask questions if you want to see some other things. Let me just give you a conclusion slide. So what we say is we've reobserved the anomalous ratio of new mu to new e's in the atmosphere. We're measuring it very well now. So that's confirmed with this new detector, which we understand very well. It's gigantic. We have lots of statistics. We understand the systematic. We also see an angular asymmetry in both low energy and high energy samples. And the new mu, new tau hypothesis fits both the oscillations and the R less than 1 number, which I didn't show you, but you want to show that it's consistent. The ratio that you get is consistent with the delta M squared and sine squared 2 thetas that you're getting. I have a plot for that if you want to see it, but it is consistent. And this is what we're saying are our measurements so far of what delta M squared and sine squared 2 theta are. This is a 90% confidence level, so it's somewhere between 1.6 and 4 times 10 to the minus 3 for delta M squared, and greater than around 0.9 sine squared 2 theta. And we can't exclude a small contribution of nu mu to nu e, because we have statistics and we can't see any less than that. We can exclude nu mu, nu sterile at the 99% confidence level with the proviso that I told you that we're only doing analysis for all going into nu sterile. We've also looked at models leading to other than L over E dependence. For example, you might say L times E, for example, is another way of another dependence you might think of. And we disfavor all the other dependences except L over E. The other thing is that, and I also didn't talk about, our multi-GeV data, we've done analysis now to look for new tau appearance. Obviously, in doing a Trino oscillation experiment, it'd be nice to see what it's oscillating into. And it's very hard in a Water-Cherenkov detector, but we now have about a two standard deviation effect saying that it's going into new tau. So it's consistent is all we could say. It's not any great observation yet. And that's as much as we can say now, because how we do it? Yeah, we make some kind of likelihood estimator based on our Monte Carlos again, which tries to look at the characteristics of the new tau interaction detector versus new E and new mu interactions in the detector and pick out what the characteristics are. No, it's statistical picking out. Yeah, we don't know any particular event, whether it's one or the other. Pardon me? No, you can't tell. Yeah, individual events. It's just statistical. And then we have... Well, you don't get new towers, unfortunately. It'd be nice, but we don't get those. okay, and the other thing is the beam experiment. That started in March. We've gotten a small number of events. It's going to run for 5 years altogether, and so we've only run 1 year out of the five so far. And that, once again, is consistent with new mu's disappearing, but the numbers are very small. We expect something like 40, and we see 20, 28 or 30, so it's still statistics are still at the two standard deviation level. We have to wait another few years in order to get that firmed up. Okay, thank you. Well, I can give you my feeling about solar neutrino experiments first, and that is that I think it's in the same stage that we were for atmospheric results before Super K turned on the air. And that means that it still could be a normalization problem that we don't understand. There's no smoking gun that points to neutrino oscillations coming from the sun right now. If you believe all of the experiments and take them literally, then there are inconsistencies in the experiments which point towards neutrino oscillations. But as an experimentalist, I think I'm allowed to throw out one out of four experiments and if I do that, then the thing could go away. So, if you don't throw it, if you don't throw anything out, then you get allowed regions in sine squared, two theta, and delta m squared space, which are down. There are three allowed, almost four allowed regions now. One the so-called small mixing angle, the large mixing angle. There's a low, and there's a vacuum oscillation region. The top ones are around 10 to the minus 5 eV squared, and Super K's observations now of the spectrum, the shape of the neutrino spectrum, and the fact that we don't see any deviation in the observed spectrum have limited those regions. And so now we've thrown out at, say, the 90% confidence level, the small mixing angle solution. And we're favoring the large mixing angle solution. But all that means is we don't see any effect yet. There's no deviation that we can attribute to oscillations other than we see a fewer number of neutrinos than expected. No, this is way up. This is nu mu to nu tau, presumably. And that's up to 10 to the minus 3 eV squared. The other, I don't know what it is, but it's nu e going to something. Either nu e going to nu sterile or nu e going to nu mu. And that's down around either 10 to the minus 5 or down 10 to the minus 10 or 11 in the vacuum region. Yeah. So.
Yeah. You presented, very convincing evidence that there's this curious correlation between two completely unrelated quantities, the size of the Earth and delta m squared from the
neutrino. It happens sometimes.
Okay, so one of the skeptics might worry that there's some unknown physics about neutrinos passing all the way through the Earth, which could be coming in here. Am I correct in thinking that your long baseline accelerator experiment will sort of...
Yeah. Well, it'll do a couple of things. There's still a solution that's possible for neutrino decay. Most of the other solutions get ruled out because of the large energy range that we look at, and you can't get consistent results over that large energy. Neutrino decay, there's still a region where you can, and the long baseline experiments will rule that out once they're finished. So, I mean, there's a lot of neutrino experiments that are happening or starting to happen. K to K is first, then there's the Minos experiment, which will turn on in a few years, which will be much better than the K to K experiment because the statistics will be much larger and they'll have a larger region that they're sensitive to. And then presumably there's going to be an experiment of CERN to Grand Sasso, the OPERA experiment, which is dedicated to seeing tau appearance in the detector.
Harry Martin?
My question was sort of following up on David's, but I wanted to ask about the snow experiment, not specifically about neutral current interactions, but just their charge current results alone,
right,
the energy spectrum.
Right.
Will they substantially advance the understanding of hydrogen?
In principle, I mean, you could take their measurement as being exclusively charge current, and Super K's measurement as being a mixture of charge current and neutral current, because we look at elastic scattering, so the small 1/7 of it is neutral current. So in principle, you could try and separate the two and see if you see the full neutral current signal. I don't know if statistics will be good enough to be able to do that until they actually do their neutral current experiment itself.
I was sort of wondering if
right, that's what I hear.
Will that really be decisive just on the charge?
I think we'll have to wait and see what the results look like. I mean, in principle, should be able to say something. But, I've heard some people say they may not even give their absolute charge current rate because they want to wait. They don't want it to be done with Super K's result. They want to wait and do their own neutral current. I don't know whether that'll happen or not. Well, as you know, a lot of people discount the result for one reason or another. I don't know, but it'll be decided by this mini Boon experiment that's going to be run at Fermilab shortly. So I think we just better wait and see. It'd be nice if it was right. It'd be a very, very rich field at that point.
Further question?
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Tea and cookies.